Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for November 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. It has been almost a year since the District of New Jersey introduced its local patent rules on January 1, 2009. In this podcast, we look at the changes to the New Jersey rules and look at their effect on patent litigation 1 year later. My guests for this podcast are Stephen Roth and Philip Johnson. Stephen Roth is a partner with the Westfield, New Jersey law firm of Lerner, David, Littenberg, Krumholtz, and Mentlich, and has been involved in patent litigation in New Jersey for many years. Philip Johnson is the Chief Intellectual Property Counsel at Johnson & Johnson in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Prior to joining Johnson & Johnson, Philip Johnson was a highly respected patent litigator. Modeled after the local patent rules for the Northern District of California and the Eastern District of Texas, the New Jersey rules are the same, only different. Stephen Roth explains.
The rules relatively track the Northern District of California. So the difference between the New Jersey rules and the Northern District of California were primarily the Hatch-Waxman cases, the DJ cases, and the standard confidentiality order, even though those issues were addressed in the Northern District of California and other districts that adopted local patent rules. So there is relatively a harmonious consistency between the New Jersey rules and the Northern District of California rules and other districts that have adopted such local patent rules. So I don't think New Jersey is a large distinction. Though if there is any distinction, it's the reversal of the obligations in the Hatch-Waxman cases, essentially forcing the defendant to come up with its non-infringement position.
The pace of the litigation is determined in the initial scheduling conference. After the complaint, answer, and reply are filed and exchanged, at the initial scheduling conference, the magistrate judge can modify the obligations and deadlines set forth in the rules to accelerate or modify the schedule. The scope and timing of any claim construction discovery and the format and duration of the Markman hearing are also determined at the initial scheduling conference. The initial scheduling conference also deals with the need for a discovery confidentiality order. The rules provide that, pending entry of the discovery confidentiality order, discovery and disclosures deemed to be confidential by a party shall be produced to the adverse party for outside counsel's attorney eyes only, solely for the purpose of the pending case. They should not be disclosed to the client or to any other person. Within 30 days after the initial scheduling conference, the party shall either present a consent discovery order, or one party may apply for entry of a discovery confidentiality order. The rules provide a court-appointed template confidentiality order. Like their California counterparts, the New Jersey rules effectively add a second layer of pleadings in the form of particularized disclosure of claim construction, infringement, and invalidity contentions. Rule 3.1 provides that no later than 2 weeks after the initial scheduling conference, the party claiming patent infringement must serve a disclosure of asserted claims and infringement contentions. This disclosure must provide incredibly detailed particulars of the claims alleged to be infringed. As to the products or processes alleged to be infringed, the identification should be as specific as possible. These are referred to as the accused instrumentality. Each product, device, and apparatus is to be identified by name or model number if known. Likewise, each method or process is to be identified by name if known. If a method or process is said to be used by the use of a particular product, that product is to be identified by name. This particularity requirement can cause difficulty when the plaintiff knows of some products that infringe, but may not be aware of all such infringing products. These infringement contentions take the form of a claim chart identifying specifically where each limitation of each asserted claim is found within the accused instrumentality. A plaintiff must identify whether the limitation of each asserted claim is alleged to be literally present or present under the doctrine of equivalence. If contributory infringement is being alleged, details must be provided of the acts of the alleged indirect infringer that contribute to or are inducing the direct infringement. Some of the particulars provided at this stage anticipate facts that the defendant may wish to rely upon in mounting its defense. Firstly, for any patent claims that claim priority to an earlier application, the plaintiff must indicate the priority date to which each asserted claim allegedly is entitled. Secondly, in some lawsuits, plaintiffs rely on the commercial success of their own product as evidence of inventiveness. In order to attribute the commercial success to the inventiveness, a plaintiff must show that its own product is covered by the claims of the patented issue. Under the New Jersey rules, where a patent owner wishes to rely on its own product or process, it must provide similar particulars of its own product or process, indicating where the claim limitations appear in it. Also, at this early stage, if the plaintiff is claiming willful infringement, it must set out the bases for this allegation. Interestingly, the infringement disclosure is only served on the other parties. It does not become part of the court record. Stephen Roth explains how these new rules have changed the practice in New Jersey.
So previously, what would happen is the only way that you could determine a party's infringement contentions would be to ask essentially contention interrogatories, you know, asking interrogatories under Rule 33, requesting a party to allege what parts of the defendant's products infringed. And most parties would object to answering those infringement contentions, saying those infringement contentions would be part of expert discovery. So essentially what you would have is this battle in New Jersey, and you would have parties refusing to answer infringement contentions, saying that was subject to expert discovery. Sometimes they would raise that to the magistrate judge to complain about it during the discovery process, but typically those interrogatories would go unanswered in the breach, or sometimes they would be given perfunctory answers and the parties would move on. And then what would happen is during the expert report period, the expert reports would be detailed, alleging all the claims of infringement. And the reason that was so detailed is because the New Jersey judiciary has been relatively strict in not allowing experts to testify beyond subjects laid out in the report. So if, for example, a defendant had three models of, let's call it cameras, model A, B, and C, and the expert only described model A, a typical New Jersey judge would not let them describe models B and C. Therefore, the expert reports were detailed. Now let's shift to what happened with the adoption of the rules. With the adoption of the rules, a party can no longer object to providing those contentions. The party must set out their infringement contentions under Rule 3.1. So now instead of the parties arguing whether or not to provide those contentions, the parties have had discussions about what the detail of those contentions are. And there's sort of two camps of those contentions. One camp is to set out the contentions extremely broadly and just almost as a notice pleading so that the party is told, you sell cameras that infringe my patent. And the cameras have all of the elements of the claim. And let's say the claim elements had a housing, a lens, and a shutter. They would say, you have a housing, a lens, and a shutter. However, some parties have taken the opposite view, and what they've done is they've tried to detail everything in more specific detail, and they've set out all three models. So you have model A, model B, and model C, and have claim charts for each model A, model B, and model C. And the fight between the parties here has been how detailed those claims should be. Sometimes parties will say, well, they cannot determine the infringement until there's more discovery. And in those situations, the parties have been allowed, and when I say allowed either between the parties or the court, to be more vague in their contentions. However, where a party could easily determine what the products are comprised of and how they're made, then it is much easier for a defendant to tell the court that that party has to come forward with much more detail. And that's sort of the scope of the detail that each of the parties have to contend with. Now, I think where the fight has laid here, and we haven't seen this flow out because the rules are only about 2 years old, and that's about the time it takes cases to get to the final jury stage in a New Jersey patent case, that if a party had this general detail, is the court going to allow them to be more specific? I think the answer to that is yes. Then the second question is, what if a party set out the infringement contentions for models A, B, and C of the camera? What if a model D comes out where the model D weren't aware of the model D at the time the infringement contentions were due? Would the court allow either an amendment or, frankly, at the time of the jury, to just have the expert testify to that fourth unnamed model? I think, no pun intended, the jury is still out on that one because we haven't seen those fleshed out. And what I think will happen is it will revert back to almost the old process, which is why I wanted to start with how the process works, that at the time of the expert reports will need to flesh out the infringement contentions in detail. And once again, if it's not in the expert reports, the judge will likely not allow a party to testify to trial.
Stephen Roth sees these rule changes as part of a pattern of the courts wanting parties to particularize their allegations at an early stage in the process.
In New Jersey, the preliminary contentions would be due, ideally within about, 2 weeks of the initial conference, which would be prior to interrogatory answers that were promulgated upon the defendant would be responded to. What it addresses is that parties need to, at least at a preliminary level, even if it's just that the defendant has some models that infringe, have in their pocket an analysis that the defendant meets all elements of the claim, at least in some general way. And actually, this follows up with the Supreme Court in the United States is going with the cases of Twombly and Iqbal. And in those two cases, the Supreme Court has narrowed the standard for what is called notice pleading. So parties used to just plead, you sell products that infringe my patent, and that would satisfy the notice requirements under the federal pleading requirements. But many courts, including the Federal Circuit, after the two cases of Twombly and Iqbal before the Supreme Court, which were non-patent cases but addressed pleading requirements, have said that parties have to plead more than just, I have a patent and you sell products that infringe. And what they say that the parties have to do is at least identify the particular claims and identify at least one particular product that infringes. And so I think you see a collective move towards parties wanting more information about what the infringement is and less game playing between the parties trying to withhold their contentions until they know more information.
Like the Northern District of California rules, there does not appear to be any requirement under the New Jersey rules for a defendant to provide non-infringement contentions, nor a claim chart identifying which claim limitations are literally absent from the defendant's allegedly infringing article or process. Stephen Roth explains.
There is no requirement that a party reply to the infringement contentions or invalidity contentions. And that's true as if it was an interrogatory answer or response to contention interrogatories. So you're correct. I mean, it does raise an interesting issue. And to continue our camera analogy, let's say a party contends that the defendant makes model A, B, and C cameras that infringe, but the defendant knows that they don't even make the model C product. That's a product made by another company, or maybe that's a product that was discontinued prior to the patent issuing. but, you know, was still in some catalog. The defendant is under no requirement to tell the plaintiff that they're wrong. Similarly, if a defendant makes an invalidity contention and potentially says something like your claim is invalid because, you know, 8 months prior to the filing of a patent, this other product was on public sale, the plaintiff who has the patent could easily possibly swear behind that reference and saying that they had conceived and reduced to practice their invention far earlier. But they're under no obligation to tell the defendant that they can swear behind that reference, making that reference inapplicable. So the purpose of the contentions are to at least get the party who has the burden of proof out there, but not require any reply.
At the same time as the disclosure of asserted claims and infringement contentions is served, the party claiming patent infringement must also produce documents potentially relevant to the responding party's case against it. For example, the patent owner must provide evidence of each discussion or disclosure of the invention to a third party prior to the date of application for the patent in suit. The party must also produce all invention documents relating to the conception, reduction to practice, and development of each claimed invention. As well as documents evidencing title of ownership of the patent rights, the plaintiff must also provide a copy of the file history for each patent in suit. In cases where it is relying upon its own product as an embodiment of the patented invention, the plaintiff must provide documents sufficient to show the operation of or elements of these embodiments. Within 45 days after service of the disclosure of asserted claims and infringement contentions, the responding party must serve its invalidity contentions. Once again, the new rules require tremendous detail in particularizing allegations. Particulars of who, what, when, and where must be provided for each piece of prior art or each prior art use. With respect to each piece of prior art that is claimed, a chart must be provided identifying where specifically in each piece of prior art each limitation of each asserted claim is found. Where obviousness is alleged, the invalidity contentions must identify any combinations of prior art showing obviousness. Together with the invalidity contentions, the party opposing a claim of patent infringement must produce documentation to show the operation or structure of any aspects or elements of an accused instrumentality. The party attacking the validity of the patent must also produce the prior art it has identified, which does not appear in the file history of the patents at issue. Any non-English prior art must have the portions of it being relied upon translated into English. The timing of the infringement disclosure and invalidity contentions disclosure, well before the Markman claim construction hearing, has interesting repercussions in pleading.
The entire infringement contention and the invalidity contention is now well before Markman hearing in New Jersey. And typically, as I was discussing, with the parties delaying contention interrogatory after Markman, they would have a Markman ruling before they have to set out either an expert report for infringement or answer contention interrogatories. Now in New Jersey, that has been on the whole reversed. So parties must make infringement contentions well before a Markman ruling and without the benefit of the Markman ruling. And parties, you know, claiming non-invalidity must do the same way. So it has, in a way, created this interesting aspect, which is I think, part of the laboratory of the states that the Federal Circuit wanted us to toy with, which is people will be making arguments for invalidity and infringement in the alternative, not knowing what the claim construction is.
As previously mentioned, New Jersey is the first jurisdiction to include special rules for Hatch-Waxman proceedings. In Hatch-Waxman proceedings, a generic drug company wants to have its drug approved, usually on the basis that its drug either does not infringe the patent owner's patents or that the patent owner's patents are invalid. It makes sense, therefore, for cases involving Hatch-Waxman disputes that the order of particularizing allegations and document production be the reverse of a regular infringement case. So the generic must go first with its allegations of non-infringement and invalidity. Stephen Roth explains why this rule was imposed.
In the Hatch-Waxman cases, the generic company, the company that has that wants to make the generic product under paragraph 4, must set out their non-infringement contentions. And the purpose of that is, ostensibly, what the panel thought, is that that party, because of the paragraph 4 requirements of the FDA, has already developed their non-infringement contentions. So it is not an undue burden for them to put out their non-infringement contentions once again. However, they thought that for the standard case with a plaintiff versus defendant, since the non-infringement issue and the invalidity issue is not a party that that party has a burden on, there's no reason to force them to go forward at the outset. And I think the Hatch-Waxman cases, the generic drug cases, are really quite different than the standard case. In the standard case, go back to my camera analogy, a defendant making a camera isn't really trying to copy the patent owner's product. They're just trying to make their own product, typically. And they don't look at the patent and copy the patent and attempt to infringe the patent. However, in a drug case, the purpose, really, of the generic drug is to make a product that is identical to, in most respects, the product sold by the ethical company. And for that reason, they're almost copying in many circumstances the patent or the product that's patented to make it identical. And therefore, the non-infringement issue comes to the fore.
With respect to document production, at or before the initial scheduling conference, the defendant must produce to the plaintiff its entire abbreviated new drug application or new drug application that is the basis of the case in question. Within 14 days after the initial scheduling conference, the defendant must provide its invalidity contentions for any patents referred to in the proceedings. It must also produce the documents normally produced by a party asserting invalidity of a patent. If the defendant is asserting non-infringement of the patents at issue, then within 14 days of the initial scheduling conference, the defendant shall provide to the plaintiff its written basis for its non-infringement contentions. This must include a claim chart identifying each claim at issue in the case and each limitation of each claim at issue. The defendant must specifically identify for each claim which claim limitations are literally absent from the defendant's alleged infringing product. Within 45 days after the disclosure of non-infringement contentions, the plaintiff must provide the defendant with a disclosure of asserted claims and infringement contentions for all patents at issue in the proceedings, together with the documents a plaintiff would normally have to produce in a patent infringement lawsuit under the New Jersey rules. Philip Johnson of Johnson & Johnson sees the Hatch-Waxman-specific New Jersey rules as evidence of interest and competence in that court.
I can't speak on behalf of Johnson & Johnson in particular, or its operating companies, but I do think that the fact that the New Jersey court, the New Jersey district's attention to patent rules involving Hatch-Waxman cases certainly will be something that will come to the attention of would-be plaintiffs, and it evidences an interest and a competence in Hatch-Waxman cases, which I think reflects the reality in the courts in New Jersey.
After the contentions are exchanged, the New Jersey rules contemplate a process for preparing for the Markman claim construction hearing. The first step is to set out what claim terms are at issue. Each party must serve on the other party a list of claim terms which that party contends should be construed by the court, and identify any claim terms which the party contends should be governed by the means plus function interpretation. Means plus function claims are supposed to be construed to cover the structure, material, or acts described in the specification and their equivalents. Within 3 weeks after the exchange of the preliminary claims list, the parties are to simultaneously exchange their preliminary claim constructions of each term identified by any party for claim construction. For means plus function claims, parties must identify the structure, act, or material corresponding to that term's function. Each party must also identify all references from the specification or the prosecution history that support the preliminary proposed construction. They must also designate any supporting extrinsic evidence that supports that construction and produce copies of any documents not previously produced. With respect to all witnesses, including experts, the identifying party must provide a description of the substance of the witness's proposed testimony, including any opinions to be rendered in connection with claim construction. The parties must then meet and confer for the purpose of narrowing the issues and finalizing the preparation of a joint claim construction and pre-hearing statement, which is due within a month of the exchange of the preliminary claim constructions. The joint claim construction and pre-hearing statement sets out the construction of those terms upon which the parties agree, along with each party's proposed construction of each disputed term. For each disputed term, they must identify all references from the intrinsic and extrinsic evidence that either supports the proposed construction or opposes the other party's proposed construction. The parties must also identify the terms whose construction will be most significant to the resolution of the case. Unlike the Northern District of California local rules, there is no default limit of 10 most significant terms. Any term whose construction will be case or claim dispositive or substantially conducive to producing settlement must be identified. Markman briefs are then subsequently exchanged and a claim construction hearing is scheduled. Stephen Roth sees the new New Jersey rules as a real advantage to patent cases in New Jersey.
This has been an advantage in New Jersey. Sophisticated practitioners in patent law have always been adopting this process on their own, even if the court didn't require it, because it's just easier to brief things that way once you know what a party's claims are and what their interpretation is. But often you would have defendants or plaintiffs who weren't as familiar with the patent process, and briefing Markman with those parties was very difficult because you never knew what they were going to argue. The reply briefs had all the information in it, which often you couldn't respond to because the replies are disfavored. So what this does is it forces all the parties to go to the Markman hearing in the way that I think the most sophisticated parties would want it. So I think the early disclosure of claims and support in the evidence and the simultaneous briefing by both parties has been an advantage in the claim construction process.
According to Stephen Roth, the New Jersey rules have changed the environment for patent litigation in New Jersey, providing greater uniformity in procedure.
I think it has made the patent practice in New Jersey much more uniform. New Jersey has, it's a large district with a great number of judges. I mean, as you, I don't know if you're familiar with in Canada, but in the United States, the districts are set up usually by state, and some districts have one judge in it. And whereas in New Jersey, I think there's over 26 judges, and those judges have quite different practices. And so your patent practice in front of one judge might be different in front of another judge in the past. So what the local rules have done is made that practice consistent. So you know what you're going to be required to do in New Jersey, regardless of what judge you're appointed to or what vicinages you're in, whether it's the northern, middle, or south New Jersey. In addition, it has forced parties to put their information in both for infringement and invalidity much sooner. Because as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, typically in the quote-unquote game playing and discovery, parties would withhold doing that till a Markman hearing, which typically wouldn't happen in New Jersey till 18 months after filing. Now parties are required to do that much sooner. I would say what I've seen on that, you haven't seen a lot of cases go to trial with the patent rules in place yet because it's so new. But what we have seen is that it allows parties to make a much better analysis of their case for settlement purposes early because the infringement contentions are laid out in detail. And as importantly, the invalidity contentions are laid out there. So the plaintiff can more reasonably approach settlement knowing what the advantages and disadvantages to their case are very early. I mean, for example, from personal experience, we had a case where we were we were charged with infringement by a company. And we didn't believe our product infringed at all, and we thought their claim was invalid. So we weren't really expecting them to initially to sue, but they continued to threaten lawsuits with us, and they had sued other parties. So with that apprehension of suit, we filed a DJ action. And a substantial reason for filing the DJ action was so that we could determine the defendant's, you know, they're the plaintiff, patent owner, infringement contention, because we wanted to know how they really thought our product infringed, because we didn't think it did infringe. And we were able to find out that information quite early because of the local patent rules. And I think if we didn't have the local patent rules, we would have possibly had a different analysis on filing the declaratory judgment action, because if we filed the declaratory judgment action without the local patent rules in place, we would have still ended up in a situation where the party would have likely refused to provide us with their infringement contentions until, you know, a year to 2 years into the case.
Philip Johnson of Johnson & Johnson echoes Stephen Roth's comments.
Well, I would say the principal benefit of the new patent rules, given that they've been well thought out and promulgated by the district, is that there will be greater organization and structure brought to the cases, and that the litigants and the court will all be aware of what the normal progression of a case is expected to be in New Jersey. And I think that will be well received by many practitioners who find themselves litigating in New Jersey.
Each jurisdiction is trying to improve patent litigation procedure in different ways.
You know, whereas you have actually in the Southern District of New York, you know, many judges over there, you know, in particular Judge McMahon, she will require parties go to claim construction before discovery, before interrogatories are served. And so she has a different approach. What she does is she says, well, a case gets in front of her, and she says, I'm just going to have a Markman hearing. We're going to do nothing but have a Markman hearing and go right to that, which is an additional, you know, approach, and, you know, is unique in its own right. And people are toying with the idea that, you know, and there's lobbying of Congress in the United States to possibly have changed the right to appeal to the Federal Circuit so that a party would have the right to have an interlocutory appeal on Markman directly to the Federal Circuit as of right. And, you know, you could see a situation where instead of the rules having infringement and invalidity first, have Markman first, and then have Markman reviewed by the Federal Circuit, and then send it back down for invalidity, infringement, and then trial. So I think this will shape out over the next decade, really, with the Federal Circuit as to what's the best.
Other states are following the examples of California, Texas, and New Jersey. The process of procedural reform is only just beginning. My guests for this podcast have been Stephen Roth, a patent litigator and partner with Lerner, David, Littenberg, Krumholtz, and Mentlich of Westfield, New Jersey, and Philip Johnson, the chief intellectual property counsel at Johnson & Johnson in New Brunswick, New Jersey. For further information regarding the New Jersey rules and information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.